Ready now. So Genesis 22 is where we are. We have not. It's been a month since we were back in Genesis 21. But Genesis 12 through 22, that basically gives us the life of the life of Abraham and his various the foundational role that he plays in the. For Israel, Genesis setting up and telling us basically the origin story for the nation of Israel, but also the origin story for God's promises and what and how he will deal with the curse that is on the earth and turn things toward blessing, how he intends to bless all the world, and that's coming through Abraham. Of course, his life extends all the way through into chapter 24 and 25, and so there's more to his life than just these 11 chapters. But the whole point of these 11 chapters is to say, here's what God intends to do, and here is the right response to what God intends to do. Here's the right response to God's promises. So let's try to recollect. Let's try to recall some of those promises. So what is it that God promises to Abraham? Land. Good. Well, hold on. Let's stay with the land. Land in a specific place, right? And he goes from, where is he at? Where is he when he first hears about that promise? Outside of that land. That's a great answer. he's with his family, right? He's where he's grown up. And he's being called out of that, land, and then to a land that God will show him. What are the other chapters in between 12 and 22 where the land is dealt with? And just remember, go into the land, and then there's something that happens at the end of chapter 12. There's a famine, right? And then Abraham leaves the land, and so Abraham's running away from this problem. It's demonstrating a lack of faith there. But then chapter 13 comes around, and Abraham tells Lot, his nephew, choose what you will have, right? And Lot lifts up his eyes, and he sees which land?
A well-watered
plain
of the city.
Yes, yeah, he sees the valley, where the cities of the valleys are, and the place where the men are exceedingly wicked, right? So that's the land where Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities of the valley, are. And we have the ominous note that says, this was before the Lord destroyed the cities, right? and then as a result of that, or on the heels of that, God appears to Abraham and reasserts the promise of the land. Okay, so that would be the land. And then the next chapter, in chapter 14, Abraham is acting like a king, going against these other kings, and doing what still other kings were unable to do. He goes up against five kings, or four kings, and four kings from the east, and he waylays them. They have no shot against him and his 318 trained men, right? And so he's acting like a king. Obviously, that's also where he meets Melchizedek, who's a king of righteousness, king of Salem. But he's acting like a king, and that's important because kings usually have a realm. They always actually have a realm, unless they've been kicked out for whatever reason. So a king, acting like a king, operating in a land that's promised to him. So that's one promise. What's another promise?
The seed,
yeah.
He has no children.
That's a problem if you're promised a land, and
yeah.
So is this land only going to belong to him and Sarah?
He's going to maintain ownership of it.
Right. Yeah. How's he gonna do that? So, what are some of the challenges that he runs in, or what are the challenges particularly his potential solutions, whether they are his own or he is convinced to have these solutions? What are some things he brings up?
Steward would be.
Yeah.
Eleazar
of Damascus, right? You promised me, that's in chapter 15, you promised me a son, but Eleazar of Damascus is my heir. And that's actually chapter 15. That's when God promises, no, it's going to be a son. A son coming from your own body, right? And so he's not going to be your heir, but your own son is, and that's the chapter where God leads him out of the tent, has him look up to the stars, and says, so shall your descendants be. And Abraham believes in the Lord, and the Lord counted it to him as righteousness, right? And so that's before the promise is obviously fulfilled, but he believes that the Lord is able to do this, and that makes him, the Apostle Paul in particular, points at that event to say, this is how we are justified. We are not justified by works. We're justified by faith in God's promises. And Christ has come, and that's who we're justified by. We trust in him. That's what Romans and Galatians in particular teach. So Eleazar is one. What's another one that comes up? What?
Hagar.
Now, what's interesting about who? You want to talk more about that, Jude? Because Hagar is not the son.
No.
So how does Hagar enter the picture?
She was the slave of her servant or whatever of Sarah.
Good. Yeah. And she was probably part of the gift that was given to Abraham as a result of the episode in Egypt where he says that Sarah's my sister. And who proposes the solution that Hagar will bear a son?
Sarah.
Sarah's idea. And Abraham listens to her voice, right? And does that work out? Well, I mean, there's a son that's conceived, right? His name's Ishmael. Not according to the promise. Sarah rejects the thing. Like, she makes a complete 180.
We're still suffering the consequences.
Yes, and Hagar does not, she doesn't act very well in that. Everybody's acting poorly there. And then in the next, that's chapter 16, and then in the next chapter, chapter 17, God makes a promise again that your son, you will have a son, and what does Abraham say? Oh, that Ishmael might live before you, right? And God says, no, you will have a son through whom? Through Sarah, right? So you have, okay, this son is coming from Abraham and Sarah. These are the two parents. So no getting around this. And obviously they're both old. And so that's a problem. But Abraham, he believes that promise. He's acting as though he believes that promise. So that's land and seed. What's the last one?
Nations will be blessed through all the nations.
Yeah, so generally just blessing, yeah. Right? We haven't necessarily seen that part, but we are here in this chapter. That will be reiterated. So,
we haven't seen him being blessed.
No, we haven't seen that promise being reiterated. I mean, we've seen him being blessed, yes. But as far as this blessing that goes into the future, that is a major part of chapter 22. So so that brings us into chapter 22. Now, at the end of chapter 21, we have this dispute over the water at Beersheba, the well of water at Beersheba. Abraham plants a tamarisk tree, and so he's like, okay, this is my land. This is where I am. He's got water rights, but he doesn't have any land ownership still. But he's got water rights in this area, so he has some security. Things are looking up as far as the land goes. Oh, and by the way, with the land, he's already been told in chapter 15 that his descendants are going to be staying in a foreign country for a while, even be in bondage. And then they're going to come out, and that's when God will dispossess the nations that are in this land, this promised land, and Abraham's descendants will receive that land then. So Abraham knows, like, okay, there's this like 400 year period that's upcoming, and I'm still believing the promise. So things are looking up. Isaac has been born. He was born in chapter 21, Ishmael and Hagar have been really rejected, kicked out of the family, and that is according to God's command. And but God still provides for Ishmael's and Hagar, but Ishmael in particular, and he's on his way to being a great nation. So that brings us up to chapter 22. And so I'm going to read this. We're only going to do verses 1 to 19, or we'll get as far as we can. And this is great stuff. So get ready if you're not already right now. Now it happened after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, here I am. Then he said, take now your son, your only one, whom you love, Isaac, and go forth to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac, his son. And he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from a distance. And Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there, and we will worship, and we will return to you. Then Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and put it on Isaac, his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Then Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. And he said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him. And Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and put him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of Yahweh called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not stretch out your hand against the boy and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only one, from me. Then Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, there was a ram after it had been caught in the thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place of that place, Yahweh will provide, as it is said this day, in the mount of Yahweh it will be provided. Then the angel of Yahweh called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares Yahweh, because you have done this thing and have not spared your son, your only one, indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gates of his enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have listened to my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and walked together to Beersheba. and Abraham lived at Beersheba. Great stuff. So what do you observe, and what kind of questions do you have after reading it?
Verse 5, Abraham said, I and the lad will go yonder, we will worship and return.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like he didn't have any doubt in his mind that God's going to provide.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But he took his son in obedience.
Mm-hmm.
In obedience, mm-hmm. he took his son. I mean, when the son asked him, where's the man? And he said, God will provide. So he did not question God. He did exactly good. What he told him.
Good. Good. So there's no but God, like, no but you said this or whatever. He obeys, yeah. And but in the midst of that obedience, he's confident. He's sure. Good. Good. What else?
Abraham's response when he's called to is always, here I am.
Mm.
Several times from God, from the angel, from the son.
Yep. Yeah, that's a consistent consistent response to that, yeah.
Isaac's a pretty grown boy at this point.
He would be a...
Well, it's Isaac's obedience, too.
I wonder what's going through Isaac's mind. We always talk about Abraham. But
yeah, but he's a very
Isaac's
old man.
From Isaac's perspective, what do you think mm-hmm. he's saying?
And Isaac mm-hmm. didn't run away. Mm-hmm. he, you know.
We have to wait a couple chapters to get the payoff about Isaac. But
this is a pretty good picture.
But that is a good observation that Isaac is involved here too, but the focus is definitely on Abraham.
Yes.
Because that's where the focus has
yes.
been. This is about Abraham's faith.
Right.
But Isaac he is he's trusting his father. He's we'll get to it when we get to it as far as the binding goes and everything, but yeah, it's an interesting thing that we're not told anything about, well, really, we're not told anything about how, up until the very end, we're not told about anything that's going on psychologically, internally with Abraham or with Isaac. And really with Isaac, he's just there because the focus is on Abraham. But his actions, there are definitely implications about what he believes, and him following his father to the end, which sets up well for him. He'll have his own problems, but it sets him up well.
The verbiage in like verse 2, take now your son, your only one whom you love. Later it talks about in verse 12, do not stretch your hand against the boy. Do nothing to him. For I know you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only one. Like the stress of one, it sounds very familiar from God, but the reiteration that this is your only son, your one and only, whom you love.
Not Ishmael. Yeah,
right.
You're not allowed to go out into the wilderness and find Ishmael. Yep, good. That was actually a rabbinical joke that Abraham's playing, or that perhaps Abraham plays dumb. Like, take now your son. Oh, okay. Your only one. Well, I have two. Whom you love? I love them both. Isaac. Oh, okay.
The promise, the son. Well, it's about the promise.
Mm-hmm.
God's going to keep his promise. Abraham's got to have confidence.
Mm-hmm.
God's got this handled.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, he's not going to keep his promise.
Mm-hmm. And that informs how he responds.
I mean, if he does sacrifice him, I guess God can raise him up from the dead, too.
And that's Hebrews 11.
Yep.
I think in verse 16, it's interesting. It says, because you have done this, indeed, I will bless you. Like, it seems conditional. Like, well, since you did this, now I can bless you. Instead of, like, it feels like it's conditional on Abraham's part. And we've been talking so much how, like, Abraham has nothing to do with it. Like, it's God is the one who's initiating everything. And that just feels off.
You just, are you making that assertion? You don't have any question about it? You're just like, this is off?
I'm hoping you'll teach about it.
Yeah. It does sound odd, but it's going to be, yeah.
But God says you passed the test.
Mm-hmm.
This was a test and you passed.
Mm-hmm.
What verse was that, Michelle?
16.
Yeah. Yeah, the conjunctions there are important. So getting those right are that is important. So
that's not my strong suit, so.
Well, there you go.
You're to learn.
Conjunctions are like the addition and division symbols in math.
I'm just singing the conjunction junction
song. Oh, okay. That's, yeah. I'm glad it's not out loud.
I know that in a Greek, sometimes the word if, or if you do this, if you do that, if means if you do it, but you will do it. I mean,
for the sake of argument.
Yeah,
But here, there's no if here, yeah. Yeah.
But it kind of has the same idea.
Yeah. We'll get to it. I guess Michelle didn't subtly say whether or not we'll get to it tonight. So maybe we should get going. Okay, so it happened after these things. That's bringing in chapter 21. So after the resolution of the dispute about the water and relationship with Abimelech and his people, after these things, God tested Abraham. So why does this kind of seem like a problem to us? Like just humanly speaking.
Test us has the implication that it's to find out what he knows, not to prove something.
Find out what who knows.
Like Abraham. Like to find where that.
So discovery. Type of thing?
Right.
Is that a bad thing or a good thing? Or
I think in our culture, the way we was tested, if we applied it that way, it would be in a bad sense.
Okay.
Versus the way that I think the Bible uses tested.
How does the Bible use tested?
To prove it.
To prove it. So what was the other?
To find out.
To find out. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Like it kind of tosses it up in the air. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. That was a test. I don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah, you can fail this.
Yeah.
You better get higher than 50%.
Right. And so, but tests can be a prove what we already know. Prove what is the case. So yeah, proven. Being proven, and that's a good way to do it, because is it a moral problem every time, you know, school's coming up and every test that kids take in school, is that like a moral problem? Does it just create this ethical quandary? Like, the teacher doesn't believe in me. She says I have to take this test.
It's about proving of it to the student.
Proving to the student, proving to everyone what's known, right? But what if you know the stuff? What if you know your stuff?
The test isn't hard.
You still have to take the test, but then it demonstrates that you know your stuff, right? That, I mean, this makes me think of my German test back in June. Like, I took it as soon as I could because I didn't want any time between what I had done for 2.5 weeks and that test. And because I was confident, I was in this great place about German. I know what's going on, and I can figure it out in order to translate it decently. And so the test was demonstrating that I could handle this, and I wasn't offended that I had to take a test. I was disappointed that I had to take the test because I didn't want to, but I wasn't offended by it.
Test isn't to show what we don't know, it's to show what we do know.
Yeah, show what we do know, yeah. Now here, in the context of Abraham's life, it's not about what he knows, although that does come into play. It's really about his, about faith, right? And so faith, is God going to do what he says that he will do? So that's a great ring.
That was my music player started playing.
Oh.
Sorry.
Yeah, I may have.
My volume was cranked up.
Verbally, I may have verbally started that or something. But yeah, the test here, it reveals something. There is a discovery element to it. It's discovering authenticity, demonstrating authenticity. But when we get to verse 12, it's going to demonstrate that Abraham fears God. Now I know that you fear God. So that when it comes down to it, Abraham will do what God says. And that actually is a demonstration of faith. And this would be the ultimate thing that comes up. So Abraham, here I am. And then he says, take now your son, your only one whom you love, Isaac. And each one of these are important. So son, this matches up with this is the future. Your only one, that matches up. In God's eyes, as far as the promises go, Isaac is it. He's the only son. And then this, whom you love, Abraham loves this boy. So that really, puts it in the context. Now context of how Abraham would be feeling, how he's responding emotionally. And we've already seen this kind of thing when Ishmael gets kicked out. Ishmael is the very last thing that's mentioned in the narrative. Of all the things that Abraham prepares for Ishmael and Hagar, Ishmael is the last thing mentioned. It just highlights Abraham's not happy about sending Ishmael away, but he's doing it because God told him to. And it matches up with God's promises, and that's what Sarah's pointing out. So he loves his sons, and now Isaac is the only one. So whom you love, Isaac, and go forth. So we have two verbs here, take now and go forth to the land of Moriah. Now what we should remember here is, so the take is going to come up later, but this go forth. Remember chapter 12. Verses 1 and 2. Aaron, can you turn back there and read that for us? Yeah, and really, I'll stop you when I want to stop you.
Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you.
Good. Stop. So, go to the land that I will show you, right? And then what do we have here? Go forth to the land of Moriah, so land on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. So what this is there's very similar language being used there, and actually the go forth is Lake Laka. It's go for yourself, if we're just translating it very, very woodenly. There's only two places that shows up in Genesis, and that's in chapter 12, verse 1, and chapter 22, verse 2. And that's a verbal indication of these are bookends. So the start of Abraham's faith and the end of it. All right, so wrapping it all up. Going to the land of Moriah, we'll get to this later, but the Moriah is an interesting word, and there's a lot of history there, but offer him there as a burnt offering. So there are different offerings mentioned in the Bible. In Genesis, really, there's these burnt offerings, but there's, when we get to Leviticus, there's sin offering, guilt offering, peace offering. They all have their different ways of doing things, but a burnt offering, what is it, what happens? I'm saying this because I said this morning. So I'm testing you right now. What happens? And here's the part that I'm wondering whether or not we know. What's significant about a burnt offering, a whole burnt offering? So what is it? What happens?
It all gets burned up.
All gets burned up.
But you gotta kill it and drain the blood, right?
Not in a burnt offering, because it's a whole burnt offering. Okay. The blood stays in. So you slay it without spilling out the blood. Okay. Good. And what's the significance of burning up the whole thing?
It's all for the Lord.
All for the Lord. Yeah. So it's dedicated to the Lord. Yeah. It's this offering of dedication, entire dedication to the Lord. That's what it's representing. Back in Genesis 9, when Noah gets off the ark, he offers up burnt offerings from the clean animals. So this happens regularly. Whenever sometimes I think altars are built and burnt offerings are offered on it. But he's going to go to one of the mountains, of which I will tell you. So go in a general direction. So this is exactly how he started. God told him back in chapter 12, go in this general direction to the land I will show you. Now go in this general direction to the land of Moriah, and I will tell you where exactly to go once you get there. Moriah is, he's going from Beersheba, so that's in the southwest part of Israel, and he's going into Moriah, which is more in the central part. And actually, I think it's in 1 Chronicles or 2 Chronicles, there's a link that's made between the temple site and Mount Moriah. So that's interesting. So it's probably in the area of Jerusalem. Excuse me. So he's going more into the central part of the Promised Land. So Abraham rose early in the morning. What's missing here that we typically expect from Abraham? He's just been told, go and offer up your son as a burnt offering.
No response.
Usually, when God talks to Abraham, what does Abraham do?
Ask a question.
He talks back, right? He's like the two-year-old. He talks back. But God, no, that's not how it's supposed to be. I don't want to do that. What about this? You know?
Kind of like Moses,
yeah. But here he doesn't do that. I mean, already he's passing the test, right? So Abraham rose early in the morning. I mean, if you're going to get up early for anything, then you're dedicated, right? He saddled his donkey, so he's preparing for this trip. And then he takes two of his young men, so these would be servant guys. It's interesting, later on, Isaac is called lad or boy. It's the same word for young men. So actually, some rabbis, and I don't think this is right, but it's still an interesting thing that there's two young men, and they say that these two young men, they represent Eleazar and Ishmael. It's not true, but it's still an interesting thought. It's like, okay, here's the three potential heirs, and the one ends up going out.
No mention of Sarah.
Yeah, but because this is all about Abraham, right?
But Sarah was kind of a man figure before, but not anymore.
Sarah's actually already passed her test, right? Kick out Ishmael and Hagar because it's through Isaac. She already believes the promises.
I'm just thinking.
Well, Abraham believes the promises too. But
I only had one son, but if I'm offering my son, you know, that doesn't. You know, that's gonna have a say about this. But here, there's no mention.
So, just to look ahead in chapter 23, what's the first thing that happens in chapter 23?
The death and burial of Sarah.
So there's a joke of the rabbis. There's a joke of the rabbis that says, yeah, well, they come up in commentaries. But there's a joke about the rabbis is that she did find out when they came back and she had a heart attack. You have to read between the lines to get there. But. Anyway. But we're not there yet. So yeah, Moses leaves a ton of things out. In order to focus us in on Abraham. And being good readers, we need to focus in on what is Abraham doing here. So rises early, saddles his donkey, takes two young men with him. So these are servants, and then he takes Isaac, his son, is mentioned last. Puts some emphasis on Isaac. He's also called his son, and this is going to come up throughout. Isaac also calls Abraham my father. So important, just details here that remind us of who we're dealing with. And then Abraham split wood for the burnt offering. Joey, you split wood. Is this an easy task? Would you say that this is not necessarily labor intensive? That's pretty simple. You don't sweat a whole lot. So labor intensive. So he's taking the wood from where he is to where he's going. So this shows he's in it from the beginning. He doesn't wait until the end to split the wood at the mountain. He splits the wood at the beginning. It shows from the beginning. Whatever he's thinking, his actions say everything. He is going to obey God. It's for the burnt offering too. And he arose, he finishes that, and he goes to the place which God had told him. So he went. On the third day, now we're tempted, hey, resurrection themes, maybe. I mean, Jesus was raised on the dead, raised from the dead on the third day, according to the scriptures, 1 Corinthians 15. There's something. So there may be something to that, that there are resurrection themes that happen on the third day and things like that. But I think it's more by inference or this is not typological for the resurrection. This just that's how long it took. Now, this could be part of the first day of traveling when they woke up, split wood, started to go on, and then a full day of traveling, and then they arrive on the third day, or it could be all of 3 days. How time is thought of is different, or it's dynamic. It can be any one of those, but it takes 3 days to go from there, Beersheba to Moriah. And then he does what? He lifted up his eyes and saw the place. This is discovery. This is Lot lifts up his eyes and sees the valley. And later on, Abraham's going to lift up his eyes. But he sees the place from the distance. This word place, it's used of later on. And so you can see how Moses actually kind of sets up for later writers or later books that he writes. He sets these things up and uses these key words in key contexts to say that this is there's significance here. But the place, God has a place where he will put his name. That's what it says in Deuteronomy about where this future temple is going to be built. So a place for my name, and that's picked up and used throughout Israel's history as a reference to the temple. And so this is just a subtle way to talk about this place where sacrifice happens, where substitution happens, and where God provides for his people. He sees the place from a distance, and then he says to his young men, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. There's a play on words here. Stay here, there. That kind of goes together in English. In Hebrew, it's po and ko, or ko and po, one of the two. But they kind of rhyme. But the important thing is he's going to go with the boy, and we will worship, and we will return. But we've got the two we's. Let's focus on the first verb. We will worship. From God's perspective, this is a test, right? God tested Abraham. From our perspective as readers, God is testing Abraham. This is a test of Abraham. From Abraham's perspective, what is this? How does he look at it?
Worship.
Worship.
His name obedient.
Right, but he's specifically, he's looking at this as an act of worship. And that includes, obviously, his obedience. But he's looking at this not as, oh, I know I'm being tested, so I better pass it. He's worshiping God, which that is, we look back on certain times and situations and circumstances and events, and we see how, you know, God was working all along, you know, his providence at work, his people at work, him exercising his sovereignty in our lives. And we look back and we say, oh, this worked out all in the end because God had it. But in the moment, what are we thinking? We might be thinking all sorts of things. But if we're like Abraham, then we have one vision. We have one purpose. We have one goal. We have one thing that we're doing. Abraham worships. We typically talk about being faithful. Whatever it is that we encounter, what do we need to do at the end of the day? Be faithful. Whatever it is that we have to do, or that we're called upon to do, or we're forced to do because of the circumstances or the events, the answer is just to be faithful, right? That's what we're thinking in the moment. And then we look back days or weeks or years later and we say, oh, this is what God was doing. But in the moment, we don't know that. We're just seeking to be faithful, right? It's the same kind of thing with Abraham. He doesn't know what's going on. He just knows he's going to worship because God has used the burnt offering terminology. This is about worship. But he also knows this is about God's promise because we will return to you. And it's intentional here. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about what Abraham is talking about or referring to. We will worship, we will return. So what does Abraham believe? God's promise about Isaac, that he is the promised son, right? So what else does Abraham believe about these events right now? Relative to what God is doing? That's a terrible question. It's so vague and so general. I'll just answer it because I don't know how to ask the question. Abraham knows that this is all entirely upon God to resolve. God has already said, no, it's through your son. Right. This takes us back to chapter 15 and into chapter 17. And then his son is born in chapter 21. Everything has been pointing really since chapter 15 to this son. And in chapter 21, he's here. He's weaned. There's a party. Ishmael is expelled. It's all about Isaac. And if God's promises are going to be fulfilled, then they're going to happen through Isaac. And so the responsibility for fulfilling God's promises is not on Abraham, but on God. And Abraham is convinced that God is going to do something. So he's going to provide. We know what's going to happen. But what you brought up earlier with, okay, if the knife does fall, and his son is slayed, he's going to be resurrected. I mean, he believes in the resurrection.
God's going to spare Isaac either way.
Right, yeah, yeah. And so it's in this position of, okay, I'm just being faithful here. God, what are you going to do?
He's being on God now. He's got full confidence.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
I think it's interesting that he calls him the boy instead of my son.
Yeah, and this is actually where that the boy, and then I think it's later on, don't raise your hand against the lad or against the boy. This is where that the servant terminology comes in. Let me check that real quick. Yep. Ha na'ar. That it's the same for earlier with the servants. So
we have Hebrews 11, 10 through 19. We have that. Mm-hmm.
Right. But he did have God's promise, right?
He did have God's promise, right?
And that's the point in Hebrews 11. It's like, here's what you can do when you do things by faith.
My footnote says,
Abraham's confidence that Isaac would return with him from the place of sacrifice stemmed from his explicit belief in resurrection.
Mm. Yeah.
And it has the Hebrews reference.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I would say that the belief in resurrection would be one implication of it. But the more precise way to put it is that he's just according to what Genesis says, he believes that God will do what he said he will do through Isaac. So Isaac is Isaac's presence in life and Isaac having a son, it's non-negotiable. It's going to happen. And so he expresses that there in verse 5. So now it's just Isaac and Abraham, and this is where it becomes profound, even more profound than it already is. Then Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and put it on Isaac his son. So where has the wood been this entire time?
On the donkey.
On the donkey. So beast of burden, Isaac becomes the burden bearer. And then Abraham takes the fire and the knife. So the wood of the burnt offering goes on Isaac. So the what will be used to send Isaac up in flames as the offering. So the offering has everything that will come with him, right? The offerer, the one who offers the offering, he has what he needs. The fire and the knife. And the two of them walked on together. But just remember the timestamp. Third day, they see the place. I mean, when you're anticipating something like and something that you don't necessarily want to do, you come to the place where that event is going to happen, where that conversation is going to happen, where that meeting is going to happen. What are you tempted to do? Run away. Call in sick. Like, I'm not doing this today. He has plenty of opportunity to do this. And he continues to go and he continues to take actions that will lead to him actually fulfilling what it is that God's commanded him to do. And the two of them walked on together. This actually becomes a mini bookend. This is the first part of it. The other part is in verse 8. They walked on together. And that wraps up what Isaac and Abraham say to one another. Isaac spoke to his father and said, "My father," recognizing here, Moses is reminding his father, like, there's a relationship here. Here I am, my son. And he said, "Behold the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering?" Isaac's catching on, right? There's something missing here, right? And this is where grammatically Abraham's response is kind of ambiguous. But what he says is key. God will provide, literally, this is God will see. Now we've come across this, God will provide for himself. We've seen this before, no pun intended, with Hagar. What does Hagar call God?
The God who sees.
The God who sees, right? Now, Abraham doesn't know anything about that. But this is, that link is intentional as far as both of Abraham's sons being provided for. God will provide for himself. So this makes explicit what I brought up earlier. Who is this actually on? It's not on Abraham. He's just obeying. He's just being faithful. It's God. God is the one who has to resolve what it is, the problem that he has created. If God didn't say anything to Abraham, we wouldn't be here, right? Abraham wouldn't be in this position. Isaac wouldn't be in this position. So God's got to resolve this. Whatever paradox is going on, God's got to resolve it. And he's convinced that he will. God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. This is where it gets ambiguous. So my son just simply could be Abraham is responding to his son. And actually, if you have an ESV, that's how it reads, is my son. Or it ends with my son. Oh, sorry, it's King James. King James starts with my son and removes the ambiguity. But this could also be burnt offering and my son being in apposition. So a way to put that is to say, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. Saying, you are the burnt offering, right? There's some ambiguity there. Whether or not that, that it just makes tension. Like, what is actually going to happen? Will there be a lamb, or will there be a son who's the the burnt offering. So the two of them walked on together. That wraps that part up. Then they came to the place. So they finally arrive to the place which God had told him. So it's not recorded, but God had told him exactly where it's going to be. They come to this place, this plain of sacrifice and burnt offering, and Abraham builds the altar. This takes us all the way back to something he does in chapter 12, and then I think at the end of chapter 13, and he ends up doing it another time in another chapter that I can't remember. But he builds an altar for the purpose of worship in these different places. And so here he is. We are worshiping. He's building this altar. There's intentionality. There's methodical stuff. And this is actually, one of the commentators I read said that this is slow motion action. Abraham built the altar there. He arranged the wood. He bound his son Isaac. Again, reminding us, we already know who Isaac is. We know who his son is. Moses puts them together. Reminding us one more time who this person is. It's Abraham's son, and put him on the altar. Now, in a whole burnt offering, what you do is you don't bind the victim, the sacrifice, the offering. You slay it, set it on top, burn it. So here, a burnt offering, there's the binding. And so if there's any doubt about whether or not Isaac knows what's going on, that's all laid waste here. Isaac knows what's going on. He's bound. Why is he bound? Not necessarily because he's struggling, but so that he will stay in place, and there won't be more than one blow. That the knife comes down and is the death blow. But him being in his teenage years, Abraham being over 100 by now, Isaac's definitely more spry, he's faster, all of that, right? So Isaac is showing this passivity, this obedience to his father, as his father is obeying God. And so Isaac, by proxy, is believing the promises. Now, that's going to be resolved where he actually does believe the promises as well later on. But he's going along. This is, Isaac is being like his father at this point. And he places them on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife. By the way, this knife is the same word for knife that's used in Judges 19 when the Levite dismembers his concubine. So this seems to be a specific kind of knife. But Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. This shows intentionality. So he's not half-hearted. He is going to do this. He's raising up his hand to do it. And that's when the angel of Yahweh comes in. The angel of Yahweh, we've seen the angel of Yahweh before. Where have we seen him? In a couple places we've seen him.
Just before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, wasn't that the angel of the Lord?
No. Those were two angels, two men, two angels. No, in the tents, yeah, that's the same thing that.
No.
Yeah, that's okay. So they're just called three men there, but Abraham recognizes that they're one of them is Yahweh. He comes up a couple times. I'll give you a couple more seconds to think. He is the one who appears to Hagar twice, right? In chapter 16, when she's initially kicked out by Sarah, and then also in chapter 21, when both of them are finally expelled. The angel of Yahweh appears in the context, in both contexts, saying he sees, he hears, he provides for a son of Abraham. Angel of Yahweh appears here to Abraham with in the context of one of Abraham's sons, is his only son, as it was put earlier. He calls to him from heaven. And so this is like the last moment. He's raised it up, raised up the knife, and he's about to bring it down. And that's when, perfect timing, right? But for God, it goes all the way to the end. So when he raises up in order to with the intention to kill his son, test is over. He's done it all the way to the end. And Abraham, just putting emphasis on it, used his name once before, uses his name twice here. Here I am. And he said, do not stretch out. So he reverses, the angel of Yahweh reverses what Abraham is doing. Do not stretch out your hand against the boy. Do nothing to him. We're done. Right? So this shows God's intention all along. Right? And it removes any kind of like, is there child sacrifice that Yahweh approves of or anything? No. And then we get into some explanation. For now I know that you fear God. So now I know that you fear God. You've passed the test. I want to talk about this word know real quick. So this does reveal the event as a test. So what we've known as readers, what Moses told us, is now Abraham knows. So this was a test. Now I know. That indicates to Abraham that this is a test. Now, remember that this is not, we need to be careful with how we do theology. So it's important that we don't use this instance, this circumstance, to create or to derive some kind of theology about God where he does not know things, where he's not omniscient, right? Is this passage about what God knows? No. Is it teaching anything about what God knows? Like, is that its central subject matter? No. What is this passage about? It's about Abraham's faith and obedience, right? So that's where the emphasis falls. And so we can call it accommodated language or whatever we want to call it, but it's not intended to say God didn't know this until Abraham did it. It's not intended to say that. And so that's important because there are passages in the Old Testament and in the New Testament about God knowing things exhaustively, God being omniscient. He declares that about himself, and those passages actually teach that. And that's where we draw that from. And so that means that we take those and then we apply it to this passage and we say, this is not about what God knows. The context says this is about Abraham's faith. And faith is, well, first of all, does that make sense? Does anybody want to poke on that? All right. So now I know that you fear God. So faith is put in terms of faith, and obedience is put in terms of fearing God. I'm wondering, this is something that I want to look into later. But you know how there are God fears and acts who they tend to be the ones who respond the earliest to the gospel in Acts. Like Cornelius is a God-fearer. Then in Acts 14, there are those who fear God from amongst the Gentiles, and they rejoice that God is saving them with this promise. There may be a connection there that I wonder about. But he's called literally a God-fearer. Now I know that you're a God-fearer. You have faith, and that faith produces obedience. And how do we know that? Because you have not withheld your son, your only one, from me. You have done exactly what it is that I said. And then Abraham lifted up his eyes. So he lifted up his eyes, saw the place. Now he lifted up his eyes and sees, and behold. Behold means what? Like, surprise, right? So this becomes this, here's God's provision, right? And it's from God. Behold marks this out as this is from God. Behold, there was a ram after it had been caught. Some translations say like behind him. It's an interesting way that Hebrew puts it, but it's the sense is probably what the LSB has here. Just after it had been caught in the thicket. So Abraham looks up, and at that moment, the ram had just been caught with its horns in that thicket. Can't get away. Like, easy pickings, right?
I bet Isaac was angry.
Yeah. Get this rope
yes,
off
Lord.
Of me.
Yes, Lord.
So it's caught in the thickets, and Abraham went and took and offered. These are the same verbs that were used for him going to the place, taking his son, and then offering him up. But this is offered it up as a burnt offering in the place of substitution, right? And so that sets up for the rest of the Bible, this substitutionary sacrifice that we see that it's begun in the Levitical sacrifices, and it culminates in Jesus himself, God's only son, right? And Abraham called the name of that place, Yahweh will provide, or Yahweh will see, right? Jehovah Jireh. And as it is said in this day, in the mount of Yahweh, it will be provided. So this is something that's continuing to be said in Moses' day and reminding the people, this is where it came from. In this moment of faith and obedience, God provides, right? God provides what we need to secure and to fulfill his promises. This is where we're going to stop. But I said that we were going to talk about Moriah. So this provide or see is in Hebrew, if we just transliterate it, it's this way. So there's actually a lexical link. There's a link between the words and how the words are put together. That connects them. So Moriah is this place of seeing, and Yireh is this place is to provide, to see, that kind of thing. And so the actual place name takes after what happens there. It's called Moriah before that, but so it's basically a play on the place name. It seems to be. But this vindicates Abraham's faith the whole time. God will provide. And he basically, he puts it on God to provide the entire way. So, test is over. And that's what's going to bring, we need to wait till next time. But the second time, this oath that comes up. So, and we'll get into those conjunctions for you, Michelle, next time, okay?
It says in the book of James.
Yes, yes, it does.
Justified by works.
Yeah. Justified. Yep. And that's important because that's the way that James frames it. He says this is Genesis 22 language.
Faith is always followed by works, by action.
Right. Abraham was not justified by faith, but by works, right? And the place that when he offered up his son, Isaac, on the altar. So he's saying that in the context of Genesis 22, not in the context of Genesis 15, which is what Paul is drawing from when he says that.
Did the works. We know Abraham's had faith because of what he did.
True, yeah. But the point I'm making is not about what people see, but about how James and Paul make their point. That they're not in contradiction because they're not talking about the same passage. Abraham is justified by faith apart from works in Genesis 15. He hadn't done anything yet, right? He's still justified.
God can see his heart.
Sure, but even then, God doesn't justify Abraham on the basis of what he sees in his heart. He justifies him on the basis of Abraham's faith. But also, this is by his grace. He's called him out, this particular one out. And that's what Paul is getting after. Is like, this is a gift, not because Abraham earned it by doing or being anything. James comes along and says, Now, that doesn't excuse any kind of licentiousness and say that you can't bear or that you shouldn't obey, or that you can be justified by faith without obedience. Look at Abraham. Look at Genesis 22, and that's what James's point is that James is saying Abraham obeyed, and this is a part of his faith. So faith obeys. So in Genesis 15, faith believes. Genesis 22, faith obeys. And so, and Paul and James are not in a fight. They're fighting different opponents back to back, believing the same things. Questions? Comments?
Gotta have one, you gotta have the other.
Yep.
Is this the first time where a lamb is mentioned as an offering?
That's a good question. I don't know.
According to the LSB app, it is.
Oh, okay. Interesting. But a lamb's not actually offered.
That's a test.
Well, I mean, that's a good...
It's not coming out prior to...
Well, a ram is what's offered.
True.
Now, we would...
But Isaac said, but where's the lamb?
Where's the lamb, yeah. Now, Noah offers up burnt offerings of all the clean animals. And a lamb would be included in a clean or a sheep.
Didn't Abel offer a lamb?
Offered from his...
He offered a blood sacrifice.
From his herd.
I don't know if it says a lamb. Maybe.
Yeah, I can't remember. But it wouldn't. But LSB would actually have it as because they translate those terms consistently. I think it just he offered up one from the from his herd.
From his herd.
Yeah. He was a shepherd of what?
Yeah.
Or is it just a shepherd? I can't remember. But yeah, that's a good question. Behold, the Lamb of God takes away the sins of the world.
This could be later, I don't know. But the burnt offering, like this stuff, and you talked about Noah, and there was Abel, like this stuff is pre-law.
Mm-hmm.
So, it seems like they're offering these up as an act of worship, not as an act of atonement for sin.
Mm-hmm. And that's what this Genesis 22 says.
Now
we don't offer sacrifices.
Yeah.
No, we don't.
Or we are the sacrifice. I understand.
So Romans 12, we're living, offer up our bodies as living sacrifices.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah. So that's what we do. Are we excluded from offering up offerings? No. Paul does that in Acts 21.
Right. I guess that's my question. Why, if this is pre-law, why isn't that something we still do?
Because we're not commanded to do it, so we're not obligated to do it. But it is. But it's something that we can do. Because it would be a sacrifice. Like you'd be a farmer. Be a rancher rather, and you take up a young calf. This represents future. This represents value. This future value, all of that stuff. And you say, no, this is for the Lord. You're free to do that, I guess, as long as you know you cover your bases legally, as far as the state goes or the county or whatever. But it's not offered up as atonement for sin. No. And this is actually where Ezekiel's temple comes in. Like there's the whole nation of Israel is consecrated as priests. They lead the worship of the world. And that does include these offerings. What's interesting is what's missing is there's no recounting, there's no sin offering, there's no guilt offering that's offered for sin. Sin offering and guilt offering is included in the consecration of the altar and I think the consecration of the people, but that's because those offerings are like super value meals. You put them together and they do different things. They function in different ways, but you still call it what it is. But it's not atoning for sin. So in the future, I believe that there will be in the millennial kingdom, resurrection body. I'll go to Jerusalem and offer up a whole burnt offering.
Not for atonement.
But a whole burnt offering is not, it was never for atonement. A sin offering, a guilt offering, that's what was for atonement. And on the Day of Atonement too. So whole burnt offerings were never for given for sin. And that kind of that exposes how much we don't understand about the Levitical sacrifices. That they only two had to do with sin. There's the grain offering, which fellowship, peace offering, whole burnt offering. Those functioned in different ways. Whether it was for dedication, whether it was for thanksgiving. And so those didn't have to do with sin. It was just an act of worship. Now the offering of atonement was also an act of worship, but more importantly, it was confessing guilt, confessing sin. Guilt offering involved a restitution as well. But only two of those five main sacrifices involved sin, had anything to do with sin. The other three were entirely worship.
They came and offered a dedication when they brought
right.
Jesus.
Yeah. 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 And so, yeah, sacrifices. Yeah, sacrifices don't always have to do with sin. And most of them, many of them, we'll just say many of them didn't have anything to do with sin. We want to worship and we're having a barbecue. So priests, come on, do your job. Enjoy the food with us. Whoever's around the temple, come and join us, and let me. And this is what comes up in the Psalms sometimes, right? Let me tell you what God has done for me, right? So you're proclaiming the goodness and the faithfulness of God, and how He has provided for you, how He has acted on your behalf, and what is at the center of that is this offering. That's probably a thanksgiving or a fellowship offering or a peace offering, and you and the priests get to eat from it. Like a portion is given to God. And the rest of it goes to you. So, and we'll get to do that in Ezekiel's temple. What? If it's a whole burnt offering, then no, you don't get any of it. And it goes all the way to God. But that's why I said fellowship and peace offering. So yeah, the sacrifices, it's important to know exactly what's going on. And that's actually how a book like Hebrews and Ezekiel do complement one another and don't contradict one another. They're like these, Jesus doing away with sacrifices for sin through his one-time sacrifice, that can stand, and Ezekiel's temple can stand with ongoing sacrifices. And it's also why Paul can offer up an offering when he does that decades after Jesus has died and been raised again. So, yeah. Is that, I went on about that for a while, but is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine. I have more.
Okay. You have more? Okay. Always. That's good. I like when you have questions. Okay, we'll cut it off there because I told Tripp we'd be home by 7 to eat dinner, and that's not happening. So let's pray. Father, thank you for this time. We thank you for the faith of Abraham that's on display through his obedience, that even all the way to the end, he intends to obey God, and he trusts you. That you will provide, you will do what you say you will do, you will fulfill your promises. Help us, strengthen us to have this faith of Abraham, that we would live according to this, and that we would just seek to be faithful in whatever circumstance that you give to us, not wondering whether or not this is a test or anything like that, but just to seek to be faithful, to believe your promises and to obey your commands. Please bless us as we go, and help us to encourage one another and to encourage others with this great account of the necessity of faith and your faithfulness to fulfill your promises. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.